for sure it's specific Professor Budurong. And let me say, as I said in St. Petersburg as well, that it is a truly great honor for me, and I want to mention also for my wife and our daughter, who are here today, to be present at this event, which is in honor of my father and his work, and in particular of the publication 50 years ago of this book, The New Industrial State. This is the first edition. Which was his masterwork in many ways, his most important work of economic theory, and the second book of a trilogy, which began with the publication of The Affluent Society in 1958, and finished with the publication of Economics and the Public Purpose in 1973. Now, 2 days ago in St. Petersburg, someone said that the 50th anniversary of this publication might be compared with the 150th anniversary, also this year, of the publication of Karl Marx's Das Kapital, and the 100th anniversary of the October Revolution. I think that's a bit much. Thank you. But I know my father would have liked it very much indeed. What it is fair to say is that when he brought this book to publication, and it took practically a decade from the beginning in the late 1950s, interrupted by his time in India, when he published this book, he did intend to bring about a revolution in the conduct of the economics profession and in the teaching of our subject. He always said that a revolution was the business of kicking in a rotten door. And he believed, and many people believed, that in the 1960s, the doctrines of the classical and neoclassical economics were entirely decrepit, that they were a rotten door suitable for replacement. It didn't work out that way. And what this book provoked, the fact that it was a bestseller in the United States for over a year, was read by college students all across the country and all across the world, and had its reach here in Russia and in many other places. What this book helped to provoke, unfortunately, was a counter-revolution, was the rise of a new and even more aggressive classical and neoclassical economics, the economics of the sanctity and permanence of free markets, the economics of the sovereign consumer and the impotent competitive business firm. The door, in other words, rotten though it was barricaded heavily through the epoch of Milton Friedman, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, the Washington Consensus, the neoliberal era. And by the time my father passed from the scene, this book was unavailable in the United States. It was out of print. I took it upon myself to bring it back into print. There are now two editions which will be available permanently. But I think it's fair to say that this revival here in the Russian Federation and the publication of this really marvelous volume, Galbraith Returns, represents the first, I hope, the first wave, the first echelon of an important intellectual movement which perhaps will have a reach similar to that enjoyed by my father 50 years ago, and with an effect, not just here, but around the world, which I believe it deserves. Professor Bodronov, in his letter to me, inviting me here, wrote that he thought the ideas were as relevant as ever and need to be developed from the standpoint of the new situation in the global economy. And I think that's exactly right. And we should begin by asking what is the critical idea. I would suggest that it is that the strength of a successful economy, such as the United States was at that time, lay not in some magic of marketplace, but in the broadly effective, complex organizations which gave the society and economy of that time their specific character. Organizations that were able to master the technical, the financial, the marketing aspects of advanced production, and that were able to operate in an environment of effective outside constraints. That is to say, it did not operate only for their own purposes, as the conservative economists claim they should, but that paid attention and were required to pay attention to the broad interests of the society in which they were embedded. That is to say, including the civil society, including organized labor, including consumers, including the environmental movement, including every aspect of the broader concerns around which a social organization must be structured. This is the opposite of a dogma. The economics which my father opposed was an economics created in the 18th century for specific policy purposes. Progressive in their time and place, in some ways. They had been taken up in the 20th century and on into the 21st as though they were eternal truths and as though the structures that gave rise to the economics of competitive equilibrium, which actually emerged from China really thousands of years ago, but were developed in Europe in the 18th century, were appropriate for the modern age. My father did not think this was appropriate. And he believed that we would always be operating in an environment of changing structures and that we should adjust our ideas accordingly. So from this viewpoint, for example, the problem in the USSR was not the absence of markets, but the vast scale, limited adaptive capacity of the productive units that were present at that time. And so that introducing so-called free markets brought collapse rather than improvement. And from collapse there followed the decade and a half of trouble, of internal looting and external predation, a history with which, of course, we are all familiar. And in the United States as well, the structures of the dominant and stable industrial corporations that were described in this book did not endure. What they were confronted with, ultimately, I think, were three major developments that were largely subsequent to the publication of the new industrial state. The first was the incursion, if you like, of economic systems, planning systems, and the term for the larger structure of organizations that my father described was the planning system. The incursion of planning systems that originated in the institutional structures of other countries, especially post-war Japan, Korea, Germany to a certain extent, which then tended to destabilize the older and less well adapted to global conditions corporate industrial structures of the United States. A second development was the, particularly in the early 1980s, was the rise of global finance, the return of global finance, initially under the impetus of extremely high interest rates in the early Reagan period, which reestablished the power of the great banks, of the financial sector, a power that had been disciplined in the New Deal from the Great Depression through the 1970s. And closely related to that, closely associated with it, was the capacity to create new corporate structures specifically devoted to the development of the technology sector, independently capitalized so that the scientific and engineering community, or its most advanced elements, could take advantage of the capital valuations associated with their control over this most scarce and dynamic resource, namely the provision of new technologies to the entire global industrial sector. And that is why we've got the basically the bifurcation of the American economy that occurred in the 2000s, in the 1990s and the 2000s. The rise of global finance, largely headquartered in the East Coast or New York, in New York, and the rise of the information technology sector, largely headquartered on the West Coast in California and Washington, leaving, as a consequence, a great part of the interior of the country, particularly upper Midwest, in a state of economic decay, leaving the old industrial corporations to deal with a set of power relations which they were not fully equipped to cope with, except through outsourcing, offshoring, and further hollowing out their own base. Consequences of that are in front of us today. They determine the political evolution that the United States has taken, and in particular the outcome of the last election, which largely pitted a bi-coastal professional class, one might call the financial and technological technostructure, against moderately depressed and certainly very anxious and uncertain heartland of the country, which joined the rebellion that brought the election of Donald Trump. When I spoke in St. Petersburg, a colleague from Germany came up to me afterwards and said, you know, of course, we never bought in to the free market doctrines. And I would think that's correct, that if you want to ask where in the world today does one have the industrial system that continues to function most closely along the lines that my father suggested, it would be in Germany and perhaps also in Japan. Both of them, by the way, countries whose post-war development was influenced by my father's work. He was the author of what is called in Germany the Speech of Hope in 1946 that reestablishes, set the path of reestablishing German self-government, and he played a role, and his students played a role, an important role, in the economic construction of modern Japan. A planning system to function effectively and to meet the needs of the larger society requires what my father called a technostructure, a group of people, a trained, secure, advanced, diverse class of engineers, managers, designers, lawyers, and much else, working together on terms of relative equality and shared responsibility. It is a mark of decay when one sector or another, as has happened in the United States, finance, high technology, gains a power advantage and skews the income distribution, making it very difficult for the technostructure to replace itself in the broad spectrum of talents that it requires. This is a phenomenon that we observe in our universities and which we have to design our universities to overcome. A planning system requires a competent, autonomous, detached state capable of exercising a regulatory power in the broad public interest of setting and enforcing standards. I've often argued that the mark of an advanced society, as opposed to a developing or a backward or decaying society, is not so much education, which is available very widely in the world, not so much technology, which can be placed almost anywhere, not even so much infrastructure, which is important but not decisive. It is the capacity to set and enforce standards, to have complex codes of behavior which enable the productive system to function smoothly and not to fall apart because people fail to trust it. This was a problem of consumer products under socialism. The Chinese solved it in part by importing the standards, the marketing standards of the West. The rise of Scandinavia in the 20th century had a great deal to do with wage standards. Certain egalitarianism that made advanced firms profitable because they could meet their productivity could enable them to meet the labor standards. These things are important, and it is a mark of decay when lobbies seize control of the state apparatus and erode those standards, rewarding the backward as opposed to the progressive industries. So what must be done? I think in both our countries, as well as around the world, we must seek to begin again. I believe that the study of complex organizations, their relationship to the state, to the working population, to organized labor, to science, technology, finance, this is a foundational task. It's something that we need to address ourselves to, and with which we can replace a barren, futile economics with a discipline of inquiry and criticism and constructive engagement that will again perhaps contribute something to the world in which we live. Beyond this, each country must make a strategic assessment, openly arrived at, in a setting that is democratic, that is not dominated by its bankers, by its oligarchs or plutocrats, or, for that matter, by the organs of the state. To effect such an assessment, to make it work, the distortions of vast inequalities have to be controlled. One cannot have a government that is both democratic and run by a handful of billionaires or retired generals. And my research strongly suggests that the most successful democratic societies are those that are fairly egalitarian, and that is because they have this balance of civil society sectors. Let me just close with one final word. Something that was very important to my father, it's already been mentioned this morning. It's also important to me, as I served for 20 years as the chair of the board of an organization called Economists for Peace and Security, an organization with a Russian affiliate, many close friends here who cooperated with us all through this period. Nothing works without peace. Countries work best when they work the way my father thought they should work internally. That is to say, with open discussion and respect for each other's objectives and requirements. War, as a comment that Keynes made, is the ultimate consumer of hopes and dreams and possibilities. In this age, we are as tightly bound, as interlinked as we have ever been, perhaps more so. And we are, at this moment, in a very dangerous phase. A phase marked by a toxic climate of distrust, motivated partly by circumstance, partly by opportunistic politics. We must find a way to respect the space, the distance, the difference, to overcome that mistrust, to recognize that every country has the sovereign right to work out its own problems. My father's first engagement with this country came when he met the representatives of the Red Army in Berlin in May of 1945. His first visit was in 1956. He went as far as Tashkent. In 1963, as I understand from my parents, there was a discussion with President Kennedy that he might come here as ambassador. I could have perhaps spent part of my youth here in Moscow. And Kennedy's intention in doing that cannot be mistaken. My father was his most significant advisor on the question of not getting involved in Vietnam. And Kennedy's intent in 1963, as I think General Secretary Khrushchev understood very well, was to work to bring the Cold War to an end. History turned out otherwise, but I think there could be no mistaking where my father stood in that discussion. And I can come back and close with a sentence that I love. It's a sentence that my father wrote that appeared in the inaugural address of John F. Kennedy in January of 1961. And that sentence is, "We must never negotiate from fear, but we must never fear to negotiate." And in that spirit, I think we can carry forward a conversation from this point, and I hope toward very productive results. I once again thank you for the extraordinary honor that you do me, my brothers, my family. I know my parents and my father especially would have been thrilled to know that you're making this effort to carry forward his ideas and to do so in a way which is adapted, as Professor Baudrillard said, to the circumstances that we face today. Thank you very, very much indeed.